The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, it's the strangest thing. I mean, the last week or two, it's like the entire world is catching flame, okay? It's turning on fire. You've got situations here in America, in St. Louis. You've got the Ukraine. You've got the Gaza situation, which even though there's, you know, treaties and truces, it doesn't look like it's going to last. And then, of course, you know, we could go on, but Russia and the exercises that they're running over around Asia right now, it's causing Japan consternation. So why are people not reacting? I'm watching gold. Yeah, it'll go up $5 or $6 and then somebody will knock it back down. Why are we not seeing a reaction anywhere in the markets?
Well, I think there's a lot of risks that are underappreciated, very much underappreciated. And there is this sense, as we mentioned maybe a month ago, that the central banks of the world have everything at their fingertips and under control. Mm. And they certainly have conveyed that verbally, and the market believes it. It's more than just a proposition. It's something that people have faith in, that yes, the central banks, whether it's Janet Yellen and Stanley Fisher or Mario Draghi or Karuda over at the Bank of Japan, Mark Carney at the Bank of England, these folks have figured it out. They've actually discovered something of the fountain of youth. If we had only known this 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 300 years ago, we never would have been subject to the vagaries of the market, nor would politics or geopolitics have come into the markets in any way to disrupt or bring challenges to sort of perpetual growth. That, believe it or not, is the underlying thought structure. And I think it's a misplaced belief, but it's a belief nonetheless, and it obscures or allows risk to go underappreciated.
Well, and you know, Dave, we live, it's no secret, we live in a beautiful area down here in southwest Colorado, but it's an area fraught with danger if you're not prepared for the risks. You know, oftentimes we'll have flatlanders come into the mountains unprepared. You know, I know you and your kids just finished climbing a 14,000 foot peak. And, you know, to do that, you look at those peaks, it's not just a hill climb. That's something you have to actually time correctly, dress correctly, know when to turn around if it's not right. You know, I mean, you guys have to appreciate risk when you go and do that with your young boys.
Sure. We started spending time in the mountains when I was a teenager, maybe 12, 13 years old. And so it's a way of life, you could say, and an avocation, and it's what we do as a family in our free time. So our family climbed to the top of a mountain a week ago. For my sons, this was their first 14er. And there's over 50 of them in the state of Colorado. And while we were up there, I was surprised by a number of things. First, knowing the area and knowing the time of year we are in, the afternoon usually brings rain and thunderstorms.
Right.
And of course, thunderstorms and lightning are not a good idea for family activity if you're above tree lines. It's just, like, if we could say that's an axiom, don't be above tree lines in a thunderstorm. So in order to address that particular issue, if you want to mitigate that risk, you start your climbing early in the morning, mm-hmm. and get off the mountain before the clouds roll in. It's pretty easy to accommodate. You don't have to say, well, I'm just not going to the mountains then. You just have to know when to start. It means you get up early, you eat an early breakfast or a small breakfast, and get on the road. There's three things that I observed while we watched literally piles of people climb this particular mountain. One, there was many of them that were climbing with no water. They had no packs, they had no provisions of any kind, no water bottles, nothing.
So the assumption that everything's going to go perfectly well, because, you know, at that altitude, not only do you need to have that kind of water, but you're going to dehydrate at a much higher speed.
Or perhaps with the misunderstanding that drinking from a mountain stream is somehow a good idea, because, you know, listen, if you've done that before, and, you know, I remember watching a young man get gravely ill on a mountain trail. I was probably 10 years old with my father. We went up with a good friend of his and his son, and he did. He drank from the mountain stream, and it was the next day he was in the hospital.
Mm, yeah.
And it turned out there had been a horse that had died farther, much farther up into the mountains, and had basically polluted the water stream. And he ended up with a very, very severe infection, internal infection, and he was hospitalized for over a week. Well, there was a couple of other things that I saw. Not only did they not have water, there were many of them that were climbing in cotton. This is just normal street clothes, jeans and a t-shirt. They had no wind protection, no weather protection, and that's the second thing that I saw. And the last thing that was interesting to me was that many of them were just starting to climb at around 12 noon. And that's basically when we were coming off the mountain. You need to finish. And if again, if you want to avoid the lightning storms, those usually come up between 1 and 3 in the afternoon. So if you're off the mountain before that time frame, no harm, no foul. But to start climbing into the high elevations right when the peaks should be covered in clouds, this is a dangerous thing.
Well, and you know, to be honest, Dave, I've done a little bit of 14 climbing myself, not as much as you, and had I not have known the history and heard from other people the things that you just now said, in other words, make sure you take plenty of water, make sure you have plenty of rain gear and weather gear, because every 1,000 feet that you climb, the temperature is going to drop at least 4 degrees. If you don't know those things ahead of time, I can understand why people, you know, who have never heard about mountain climbing before would show up and not really understand the risk. You know, how the boys do.
Boys did great. I mean, we had a third, as you mentioned, weather changes, even just those sort of climate changes, if you will, 30 degrees. I mean, at the bottom of the mountain, it was a good 85, maybe 90 degrees. And by the time we got to the top, with a little bit of cloud cover, 55, 60 degrees.
In the middle of July.
In the middle of July. So yeah. Very, very, but the boys did great. Granted, it was challenging, but I watched them dig deep and push past a variety of fears. We carried what we needed for a variety of changes, whether it was the wind, the rain, or anything else. And we finished before any weather came and was sort of threatening, if you will.
Well, you know, it's very obvious the analogy that we're starting to move into. Okay, the stock market continues to climb and climb and climb. It's not paying attention to geopolitical events. In fact, when I've read reviews, they're saying, well, the stock market might be a little muted in its climb based on what's going on. But, I mean, is it realistic?
There's a lot of folks that, with their retirement funds, what they'll do is, you know, speaking about their 401ks, they'll look at a target fund, which is to say, you know, I'm going to retire in 2035 or 2025 or 2015. And you put your money into that particular mutual fund, and it's a diversified fund which targets that date and is supposed to sort of take account of the risks that are going to be encountered to get you to a place where you've experienced growth and are able to retire at that point, assuming that you've put a sufficient amount of cash in initially anyways. So, you know, we were looking at a target term fund, J.P. Morgan's 2015 fund, and, you know, this assumes that a person's going to retire next year. And, yeah, going back to this notion that there are huge underappreciated risks, the allocation, as we looked at it, was 42% equities.
So almost half in the stock market.
Yeah, and the remainder was in a variety of emerging market debt and stocks as well from the emerging markets. Some junk bonds. There was a sliver of commodities in there. And by the way, that allocation, 42% allocated to equities, that's with a one-year time horizon to retirement, and it's a far lower allocation to equities than most in these sort of target funds. So quite frankly, it's the kind of deja vu I have when climbing the mountain the other day, watching as the casual dressed climber, you know, is going up a rather exposed mountain, no pack, no water, no jacket, thinking that it's going to be sort of this beautiful experience getting to the top, looking at the vistas. And of course, this is what we want in retirement, right? We've put in the pain. Now where's the gain?
Right.
Yeah. The sweat equity has been earned. We've saved. And now it's the golden years. And frankly, it's risk at precisely the wrong time. And it's underappreciated.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. I flew for years with Civil Air Patrol, and you know, we had to, unfortunately, look for people who proceeded with too much confidence and with ignorance. And you know, you can do that with mountain climbing. There's a number of things you can do that with. What you're talking about right now is retirement. You know, if you just look back at history, you understand that when you're 1 year away from retirement with a stock market that's hitting new highs, you probably don't want to have more than half of the allocation in stocks.
And as you mentioned, maybe it is just ignorance of circumstances and not being familiar with an environment. If you're a flatlander coming to the mountains, not knowing that you can have snow in the middle of July, you know, things like that come as a grave surprise. Well, confidence is the other part of that. And as you mentioned, Air Patrol, Civil Air Patrol, if you look at the statistics, the number of downed airplanes that are flown by doctors would astound you. And a part of it is that confidence, or rather overconfidence, that somehow their expertise or all-knowing transfers into all areas of life, and somehow their judgment, and again, I don't know exactly where this comes from, but again, a little too much overconfidence in that environment gets a lot of doctors killed.
Well, Dave, and this isn't to offend anybody, but actually you can find that with any profession where a person has to make authoritative, quick connections and judgment calls. If they apply that to another area, it can be dangerous. I mean, pilots, yes. You know, we used to call the Bonanza, which is a type of plane, a doctor killer, just because that's what doctors could afford. And then they'd fly from, you know, the flatlands into the mountains. And unfortunately, it was literally into the mountains. But, you know, in investments, we've also seen you can do that professionally in your investment portfolio, thinking that you understand what's going on by seeing what your neighbor's doing. A doctor watching another doctor invest is probably one of the most dangerous things for a portfolio.
Well, sure. In addition, you know, looking at sort of a limited time slice of success, you know, anyone who climbed that mountain with us that day, listen, we didn't have weather. We had a great day. The experience was the day, bright sunshine almost the entire time. No real things that would have been sort of theoretical risks. Maybe I'm on the edge of paranoid in terms of taking those things and assuming that they are going to happen so that I am prepared for them if they do happen. If you took anyone on the mountain that day, what you would find is that these are people that now have experience from the day. And that experience would give them the false idea that you can climb without water, that you can climb in a pair of blue jeans and a t-shirt, that you don't need a jacket, that it's happy-go-lucky every day and in all circumstances. And I think that, again, is where if you're construing the future upon the past, there are some issues in play. Mountains and markets, they share this in common. At times, they are unforgiving, and at times, you find risk being overlooked for the allure of beauty, the vistas which stir you deeply, the idea that tomorrow is going to be everything that you hoped it would be and that you somehow have control over that.
Well, and, you know, just in case someone's mistaking you for somebody who's paranoid about risk, Dave, you go out and take risks that, frankly, I don't feel comfortable with. I mean, you have felt comfortable climbing flat-face mountains. I'm not talking about the 14ers, but actually just pure technical types of climbs. Those types of things I'm not interested in, but you still calculate the risk, don't you? You're not a reckless risk taker.
No, right. I don't shy from risk, but I do calculate as much as possible and look for contingency plans in case I meet Mr. Murphy along the way. And there's as many or more mountains that I've turned away from and not gone to the peak because there were circumstances that just said to me there's too many risks here and I've got too many responsibilities to care about getting to the top. So, you know, many investors today, they look as out of place being in the stock market as, you know, maybe I can be a little hyperbolic here, as a woman in a cocktail dress fashionably sporting 3-inch heels on that mountainside. You just have to say, no, it doesn't really fit. Not here, not now. And it was kind of humorously that later in that day we actually did run into a group that was dressed to the nines. It was a wedding party, you know, sort of redefining the wedding destination theme at 13,000 feet. And what set them apart from the hikers, of course, was that they had access to Jeeps so they could beat a quick retreat if they needed to.
So if weather set in, they could beat a retreat. Or if the groom or bride changed their mind, they could beat a retreat. Well, you know, Dave, in the past, okay, over the last 6 or 7 years doing this show, you've taken great pains to make sure that we understand the situation over in the Middle East. And so periodically we'll have experts on that can explain the situation because the Islamic world is very complicated. It's gone from rather simple to complicated because you have, you know, Sunni and Shia and Wahhabi, and then you have the Ottoman Empire that came in, and then you had the destruction of the Ottoman Empire, and the spreading of the various countries and the lines being drawn. Turkey, though, you know, seems to play more of a key role than people give it credit for. And we've just had an election in Turkey, and I think it's important for us to talk Turkey a little bit.
You know, Erdogan moved politically sideways into the presidential suite, and he's stepping down as the leader of the AKP, that is the Justice and Development Party, in what appears similar to Putin's move a few years ago from one political post, where he was exhausting his term limits, right into another.
So it's like, you don't have to call me president anymore. You can call me chancellor or king.
Right, yeah. Right. So what is the story with Erdogan? He's likely to, in the role of president, redefine the role of president, expand the powers for the office, consolidate control of the Turkish political machine. And, you know, he has effectively in the last 10 years created what he calls the pious generation. And, you know, the pious generation sounds a lot more palatable than something that is sort of radical in terms of an expression of Islamic belief. But, you know, at this point in the country, there's only about 1% of the Turkish population which is not Muslim. This is the exact opposite of what Mustafa Kemal Atatürk created in the founding of the Turkish state in 1923. He was the general who fought the Allies, won in 22, and set up the state in 23. And, you know, so what we've seen really in the history of Turkey is the pendulum swing from an Islamic theocracy to a secular state and back again. And sometimes, you know, I would agree, listeners may wonder why Turkey and other far-flung destinations are important to us. It really, it goes back to the impact of what happened during the Iraq War.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting when we've interviewed Friedman from Stratfor and, you know, some of the other guests that we've had, they said, you know, once you create a vacuum in Iraq, it was almost like Iraq was the center of a wheel, an Islamic wheel. And when you take out the power, you know, Saddam Hussein, whether good guy or bad guy, and we know he was probably more bad than good, but you take that stronghold out and you create a vacuum. And I remember when Friedman was on and he said, you know, this vacuum is either going to be filled by the Shia side, which is Iran, or Turkey's going to step in, and Turkey and Syria, and it's going to be filled in on the Sunni side. It seems like that's happening right now.
Yeah, and it's not just the drawn-up military commitment that cost us nearly $2 trillion, but it was the destabilization of the entire region resulting from that strongman being yanked out of power and the disturbance that meant to the regional power structures. So, you know, since that time, the Middle East has been trying to define not only its orientation, but also determine how and who, really, will set the tone for the Muslim world. And so you've got all your contenders. You've got Egypt, you've got Turkey, you've got Iran, you've got Saudi Arabia. These are the contenders for Islamic leadership in the 21st century. Entree the non-state actors like ISIS or ISIL, and they have a growing importance with the key distinctive they share with a number of those other countries. They're Sunni as well.
Well, and Dave, it's interesting that you brought in non-state powers because ISIS and ISIL, they're not a state, okay? They're calling themselves a state, but they don't really care. It's a state without lines. They're just moving across anywhere they want to, you know, move across, and it's, you can call it barbaric, but it's definitely been effective. You've got people who were the enemy who were defecting over to ISIS because not only are they seeing success, but they're scared of being shot or buried alive.
It's interesting. Martin van Krevel, when I met with him at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, you know, he makes the point over and over again in a lot of his research that the state is a very modern creation. And, you know, the Muslim faith predates the existence of the state by almost 1,100 years. So, you know, you're dealing with something that has been a recurrent theme in the Middle East and certainly in the conflict between the Shia and the Sunni going back good 1,300 years, 1,400 years. But it is very interesting to see of greater and greater importance as we see, as van Krevel said, the changing face of warfare. It is not between state actors. It's between small regional bodies with different interests, and they don't necessarily align along political lines. And in this case, we are talking about something that is driven by religion. The Sunni-Shia conflict, again, literally going back centuries.
Well, I think what makes things confusing, I think, on our side, Dave, on the Western world side, is we're watching Muslims slaughtering Muslims. And this is not something new. This has been for hundreds of years, well over 1,000 years. And so I think it's important to understand the definition. What is a Sunni Muslim? What is a Shia Muslim?
A scholar could do a much better job of this. But in a nutshell, you know, it's a struggle for who represents the authoritative voice of Muhammad, who sustains the legacy and controls the interpretation of the Quran, their holy book. So you've got Iran, you've got Iraq, you've got Bahrain, you've got Lebanon. These are your Shia countries. Virtually the remainder of the Islamic world is Sunni. And the difference is a leadership dispute going back to shortly after Muhammad died. The Shia opted to follow Muhammad's cousin and son-in-law, and the Sunni preferred Muhammad's father-in-law and a good friend of his. So the Sunni, if you wanted to think of them as sort of the sola scriptura types, they focus more on the strict interpretation of the Quran and less on traditions practiced in mosques. You know, very, very popular amongst Shias the idea that there were 12 imams and the 12th imam disappeared and they're awaiting the return of the 12th imam. Well, some of this becomes sort of extra scriptural, if you will, and the Sunni are particularly critical of that. So the Shia are being slaughtered indiscriminately in Iraq today alongside Christians as if they're no better than Christians, heathens, which is somewhat ironic because if you look at the history of Islam, there were long stretches of time where they had no conflict with anyone who was non-Muslim. And I say that because they had hopes that you would convert. They might charge you a tax for existing in their land, but they would not necessarily kill you just because you had a different belief. There was still the hope that you would convert to the Islamic faith.
Well, and I think probably it's about time, frankly, that the curtain be pulled back on Saudi Arabia. Okay, when we go back to 9/11, we can go back to a number of terrorist actions that were funded by a country that we have tried to protect the identity of based on oil and OPEC and money flow and the Saudi royal family. It's not the Saudi royal family that's funding this terrorism, but within Saudi Arabia, this has been probably the main area where this radical Sunni Islam is being funded.
It's interesting, in conversations that I've had with people of Islamic faith, they have at times expressed untempered criticism of the Wahhabi expression of Islam. Their words would not be wingnuts, but it's awfully close to that. And, you know, what's interesting is the Wahhabis were empowered and given extra influence in the world of Islam because of the oil revenues. And it's certainly not the Saudi royal family that is much as a concern, but you've got families in Saudi Arabia, which have done most of the funding of the terror that the Western world has seen in the last 50 to 100 years.
Well, and what makes this so critical to understand is Saddam Hussein was an island in a sea of Shiites. He was a Sunni island in a sea of Shiites, wasn't he? And so when you take that power, I mean, he really did exert a horrible kind of power. That's how he kept the throne. But nonetheless, you pull that out, and what do? But create a vacuum and chaos.
Well, that's right. A minute ago, I said that Iraq was one of the Shia countries, along with Bahrain, Lebanon, and Iran. But you're right. It was a Sunni leader who was leading the Shia, and he did. He managed that place with an iron fist.
Mm-hmm.
He was cruel. He was brutal. And he kept a lid on the conflict, so to say. And without that sort of nasty leadership, what you have is a power struggle now. Who is in charge of the Sunni seat, and are the Shia really necessary? It's almost as if the Sunnis have a vision of Shia extinction. And, you know, so bringing the Sunni ideas back into the region in hopes of establishing Sunni leadership once more, then you've got Iran, whom we have no real love for, but they regionally are the real counterweight to the Sunni dominant Islamic world. And again, you may say, why now? Well, the reality is it's not only now, but it's been for a long time, 1,370 years worth of conflict between these two groups, the Sunni and the Shia. Now, you could argue that certainly within Christianity, the Eastern Church and the Western Church had their own conflicts, and at times it was violent. I think for several hundred years now, we've had that behind us, but I don't think that any period of time really has existed in 1,370 years where the Shia and Sunni have been at peace. The question is, should we be involved in sectarian infighting at all?
We're having to pick sides at this point. I mean, we're bombing the Sunni extremists right now. We're now having to go over to Iran and say, gosh, yes, we're enemies in one respect, but can we be allies in this other respect? You know, it's very confusing.
The enemy of your enemy is your friend. Well, 170,000 are dead in Syria so far in what is really a sectarian infighting. I mean, we'd like to put a prettier picture on that and say it's about freedom and it's about, you know, changing, just like with the rest of the Arab Spring, from a corrupt government to something that represents the people's choice and a better form of democracy in the Middle East, when in fact it is the old Sunni-Shia conflict all over again. And, you know, why and on what basis do we hold back in terms of our military efforts and at other times press in and help in others? Is it humanitarian on our part? Is it moneyed interests? I mean, I can tell you why we have military bases in Saudi Arabia. That's fairly simple. There you can just follow the money.
Right, right. Well, and, you know, we've been criticizing. It's interesting. You'd be careful who you criticize and why, because Putin has been criticized for saying he's sending in humanitarian aid into Ukraine. Yet this week we were forced to say, gosh, we're sending in humanitarian aid back into Iraq.
Now, I know, but his form of humanitarian aid, if the reports are accurate, is baby food, generators, 12,000 sleeping bags, you know, and ours is in the form of 500-pound bombs. I mean, it's a different interpretation. If you want to, I mean, humanitarian is now something that is interpreted very loosely, and particularly when it's administered by someone who has the Peace Prize versus someone who doesn't.
So maybe it's humana exterminating funds, whatever. Well, okay, but Russia. Let's look at Russia because, you know, we talk about how the United States, it's all about the oil. It's all about the money. I would have to say that that's going on with Russia as well, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you know, they're in an awkward position. The last few years of higher energy prices have built up their sovereign wealth fund. It's about $173 billion fund. That gives them a little bit of time, a little bit of leeway in terms of lower energy prices before sort of hitting a stretch of insolvency. But they do begin to bleed fiscally because of the commitments they've made, social commitments, with oil under $110 to $115 a barrel. That's what they need in order for the state to pay its bills. Russia is really not much different than Mexico in that regard. When you look at the percentage that Mexico receives from Pemex, its oil giant, about a third of its total revenues are coming from oil revenues and Pemex. So you see this sort of enmeshed relationship between energy and the state, and the state cannot do without energy. Ultimately, we destroyed Russia by taking down the oil price so many decades ago, and that's the insecurity, the energy insecurity that Russia has. Now, whether in the United States we're moving towards energy independence or not, clearly that's a disputed issue, but Russia does have access to, like any of us do, our trade balances, and our trade balances are shifting. We're moving towards surplus and away from record deficits, and that is because of the energy we're producing. For whatever time frame we have it, it's helping us right now. And they know that lower commodity prices, the Russians know that lower commodity prices spell trouble for them. They can't make good on their social commitments if they don't have the money. Now, obviously, I mentioned the $173 billion cushion. They'll continue to keep the public happy, the Russian public happy, but it seems plausible to me that Putin is preemptively reinforcing popular support and driving patriotic themes to the forefront in anticipation of softer energy prices and a likely, what would be a loss of domestic popularity.
Well, and it seems like the distraction, if it is a distraction, is working. I was reading, you know, if the polls are accurate, I was reading that the Russians right now favor Putin by over 80%, and they disfavor the West by, I think, 73 or 74%. So
right. Negative views of America, about 74% of Russians polled have a negative view of Americans. And then you couple that with Putin's popular appeal, which is sort of promoting a return to Russian destiny. He's cast a nationalist vision of historic greatness. And when you see how this is lining up, you have the good guys and you have the bad guys fairly well delineated, and we are the bad guys. Of course, that's just what we think of them, too. So this is the makings of conflict, potentially, but clearly you can see how he's defending against lower oil prices by making the issue not so much his fiscal mismanagement, which again is just a matter of oil dependency, but rather this outside attack, and that allows for a rallying of the people around him as a leader.
Well, and you just wonder, okay, you've got elephants right now who are in battle. Okay, let's call the United States an elephant, and there are Russia to a degree an elephant, and you've got the European Union also maybe as one of the elephants. Now, there are probably mice that are going to get crushed, the smaller countries that are sitting there going, you know what, you guys can sanction all you want, but this is a breaking point for us.
Well, and what's funny is it's only taken 1 week for that to happen. We had retaliatory sanctions last week, 52 weeks in the year, we've got 51 weeks remaining, and you've already got the Finnish government reconsidering their European solidarity. You know, 10% of the country's exports go to Russia. Or we're going to. 18% of all imports come from Russia.
So there's a huge impact.
This is a fairly significant trade relationship. It's not just the Finnish. You've also got Poland, Lithuania. There are countries that will now have to swallow hard as they face the marginal erosion in their economies, which may be enough to re-trigger recession. So for Finland, the hope has been that recovery would be tied to this increase in exports, which, as of today, is an impossibility.
Well, and, you know, even the larger countries, okay, I don't want to necessarily call Finland a mouse, but Germany is no slough, and they have a huge exposure to Russia.
Sure, you've got 6,000 companies in Germany with significant trade to Russia. They'll be feeling the pinch. The next quarter, as we look at GDP statistics for Germany, it'll be adding stress to an already tenuous economy. And fascinating this week that it appears that Spain Spain, of all countries, is pulling ahead of Germany in second quarter GDP growth.
Hmm.
And this, of course, I mean, just to change the topic a little bit, raises the issue, it's a very controversial question, of whether or not austerity works. Now, that's austerity that's been employed in Spain. Might it, in fact, work just on a lagging basis? Because certainly there's criticism that we need to print more and print more and print more. And yet here you have those who have refused to print on the one hand, the Germans, and not actually imposed very much austerity. In contrast, so they're sort of grinding to a halt, if you will, slowly, but they've had a stable labor environment, and that has helped. Contrast that with Spain, Italy, and others who have taken it on the chin and have put in major, major austerity reforms.
Well, and in Europe, isn't it very similar there as it is to here that the people who actually take the most impact it's the middle-sized to the smaller businessman. It's the entrepreneur. It's somebody who's going, you know, I'm just trying to make it here. And they're usually the guys that take it on the chin.
Oh, sure. Because you look at a company like General Electric or any of your multinationals, they not only have diversified product lines, but they source product from a variety of places. They manufacture product in a variety of places. They distribute product to a variety of places. And so any one multinational, even though they may have a particular focus, still has some diversification, if you will, in the mix. And you know, the business strength in Germany, about 52% of the economy, is driven by specialized, non-diversified manufacturers, known as the Mittelstand. These are your entrepreneurial, small to medium-sized businesses, and many of these, they do a concentrated amount of business with Russia, where, again, third to a half of their business is done with Russia, you know, and that's dangerous. In an environment like this, all of a sudden solidarity with the EU and, you know, imports and exports changing, are these sanctions or is this a new trade war?
Right.
And so you clearly have these smaller businesses that are affected. And then you've got firms in Eastern Germany, which have traditionally had higher percentage of business done with both Eastern Europe and Russia, who will feel the most pain.
Well, and I'm thinking about some of the past interviews we've had, even with Otmar Issing, who, when they were putting the euro together, of course, he was the head of the European Central Bank for about 7 years. He was one of the brain trusts that put together the euro in the first place, but he always had a concern that the financial might have to be affected by the political, and you don't still have that kind of political unity that they've put into the financial side. Now, at this point, with the strains that are going on with Russia, it's forcing a cost. There is a true cost to being a euro member at this point, is there not?
Well, that's the point, isn't it? Because you have to say to yourself, am I a European or am I a Finn? Am I a European or am I a Swede? Am I a European or am I Italian? Am I a European or am I a Spaniard? I mean, these are the things where you say, first and foremost, this is where I was born. The blood that courses through my veins is X, Y, Z. And that's, again, you put a flame to the finish and all of a sudden they're not Europeans. They're very much Finnish indeed. And that's where you can see these commitments made. I don't know that you can last a full year with the retaliatory sanctions that we've had from the Russians thrown back on the EU.
It is strange, again, that it's been 100 years since we saw these same questions being asked in 1914 before the beginning of the war that was supposed to end all wars. But, you know, the question would be, what does it cost to be a European? Well, I'm going to ask the same question. If I were sitting in Asia right now and I was watching the United States just printing dollars and I had huge amounts of dollars and I had to stabilize my own currency with, you know, to in parity with the dollar. Well, I would ask the question, what does the dollar cost me at this point?
This is where I think the world of finance and economics and geopolitics is so fascinating in its interconnections because, you know, on the one hand, we've got a conflict with Russia and the EU. We've got the U.S. Treasury wanting to tighten down controls in terms of sanctions on the Russians, particular companies, particular sectors, particular people. And so corporations in Russia are deciding that they're not going to have dollars as a part of their treasury holding, if you will, in their coffers, in their war chest. It's no longer going to be treasury bills, treasury bonds, notes, or other forms of dollar holdings. And they're moving massive amounts into the Hong Kong dollar. And so in Hong Kong, it's been necessary over the last 5 weeks to spend valuable resources and or run the printing press to maintain the fixed dollar relationship that exists between the Hong Kong dollar and the U.S. dollar.
Because there's a flood of U.S. dollars coming into Hong Kong.
That's right. And they have their currency pegged to the U.S. dollar. So the rationale on the part of the Russians is, we want the relative stability of the U.S. dollar. We just want to be outside the reach of the Treasury, which in itself is a fascinating commentary. The fact that they're thinking about being outside the reach of the Treasury, and this is something that's being made. This is a decision that's not being made just by individuals, but corporations and central banks. So that's, I think, a preview of things to come over the next 3, 5, 7 years is this sort of insulation from Treasury. Hong Kong dollar, you know, what has happened there? Major influx into Hong Kong dollars by buying up foreign currency, flowing in to neutralize the impact. This is what the Hong Kong Central Bank has had to do. They've had to buy up that foreign currency, neutralize the impact of the buying. Otherwise, the Hong Kong dollar would have skyrocketed. And in the last 5 weeks, it's taken them $9 billion.
Wow.
To keep their currency stable and not going through the roof. I guess what this highlights, what it highlights is a problem that nearly 50 countries around the world have. And that is that if you're dollarized, or if you're maintaining a peg to the U.S. dollar, it means that U.S. monetary policy, as loose as it has been, is one of the U.S.'s primary exports. And so I guess you could say our exports have been on the rise via our monetary policy and the dollarized and pegged countries that are out there.
Well, and you think about that $9 billion. That may not sound like much in the scheme of things, but there's nothing productive that comes from that. That's just it's spending $9 billion to weaken your currency.
Right. So as corporations are seeking to avoid the U.S. Treasury controls, but again, given the peg to the dollar, they are making what they consider to be a strategic move. The Hong Kong authorities have to respond to that and spend capital to avoid massive increases in their own currency's value. And that defines the dollar relationship as a costly relationship. What does the dollar cost you? In the last 5 weeks, it's cost the Hong Kong authorities $9 billion just for the sake of the peg.
And it's not just in Hong Kong. It's not just the Asians. It's not just people outside of our own country. Even the U.S. multinational firms, they're having to dance to keep their dollars from coming back in. I mean, they're trillions of dollars.
You know, I have to be honest, this is one of the most striking illustrations of how ignorant our government is. And I say that somewhat taken aback because there are many illustrations and this just happens to be one of the most striking. They're sitting, U.S. and multinationals are sitting on $1.95 trillion in overseas cash. And they're telling the story in this decision-making process of concern about regulatory and tax uncertainty. And this is something that government should be paying attention to. This is something that the Treasury, this is something that Mr. Liu should be paying attention to. Of course, government tends to seek enforcement measures which alter behavior in sort of a command and control fashion. And that's really not how the market works. U.S. corporations have left their cash overseas because of the circumstance that U.S. Treasury and the IRS have set up. Government tends to try to alter and force behavior, punitive measures, restrictions, etc., to get that money back. I think they could learn a tremendous amount by looking at how the Swiss cantons operate on terms of their tax system. It's actually very similar to what we've done here in the United States with Delaware and with Nevada and with a number of states that have a more compelling proposition for corporations. Why do many corporations and LLCs incorporate in Delaware or in Nevada? Because these state governments have said, you know what, we can do a better job. We can create an environment that offers greater protections for corporations and offers a lot less red tape. And in some instances, there's even tax advantages to boot. This is exactly what the Swiss have done for decades, where each canton will compete. Each canton is almost like a state within the country. They will compete for you to domicile your business in their state, and you can actually go into the tax authority and negotiate with them what the tax is that you will pay in terms of your state tax, if you will.
Well, and we see that even in the United States at this point, where you start to see governors of states campaigning for businesses to come in, and you see this exodus of businesses going out of states like California. I mean, you live there. California is a beautiful place, but let's face it, it's a horrible place to have a business.
Right. Now, and I know a number of people who still operate businesses in California, and guess what they do? They've moved residency to Texas, they've moved residency to Arizona, and they spend as little time in the state where the business is as possible. And the income that they accrue on a personal basis is on a very different basis treated. I don't know if they're doing that properly. I'm not a tax expert. I couldn't say. But all I do know is that our government is missing the boat here. 1.9 $5 trillion of money that could be sloshing around our economy, and it's not, in large part, because our tax structure is such that it's not, they're not interested in repatriating the funds.
So if it comes back, they're charged 35%, but if they wait for a foreign acquisition to come about, then they can go ahead and spend that and not have that hit. Is that right? What you're saying?
They don't have to take the tax hit. They keep the powder dry. They can expand their business overseas and very effectively use those funds. The alternative would be something like a flat tax, 10%. 12%, 15%. I don't know if there's a magic number, but let's just say, just for the sake of simplicity, 10%, and you do away with all exemptions, all loopholes, everything. Every corporation pays 10%. Do you know what that means? That means that General Electric, who paid 0% last year, the year before, they've got all kinds of tax credits that they work out. They would have to pay their fair share as well. So the little business is not paying 40, 50% all in, and the big business paying zero. It's just a fair 10%. Do you know what that would do? You would put yourself at the lowest level of taxes in the world, and all of a sudden, what Mr. Liu, Dr. Liu, is trying to do in terms of stopping corporate expatriation, as he likes to call it, you would all of a sudden be a magnet for talent, a magnet for corporate construction here in the United States. Create the advantage and grow the environment. This is the business way. And what we see is the instincts of command and control. That's what's disheartening. But you know what? U.S. multinationals have a nose for command and control, and that's why you have $1.95 trillion sitting outside the United States. Tax uncertainty, governmental regulatory uncertainty, and opportunities that lie elsewhere, why wouldn't you take them? I mean, this is the calculus amongst corporations, and it's actually pretty consistent with the milieu created by our government.
Well, unfortunately, though, Dave, and I hate to be a Debbie Downer, but you eliminate the lobby and you eliminate preference, okay? Because what we see is we see preference being thrown around. You know, the bailout that we've experienced since 2008, let's face it, it's been a bank bailout. Talk about preference. When somebody says, you know what, you're just a little too big to fail. In fact, you're way too big to fail, so we're not going to let you fail. Well, that eliminates, talk about preference, that eliminates any kind of, you were talking about acknowledging risk. Why would you worry? Okay, let's go back to the mountain climbing example. Let's say that there were helicopters following you all the way up the mountain. And any time you started to go a little bit of a wrong direction, those guys would say, well, we're here for you. There's nothing that can go wrong. We've got plenty of water. Oh, you didn't bring water? There's plenty of water here. Oh, you didn't bring rain gear. Yeah, yeah. And so
we'll get that to you.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
The Wall Street Journal reported that banks, U.S. banks, had the second highest quarter of profitability in 23 years. And what's interesting is certainly there has been a stabilization of the financial system. But again, this goes back to the notion of risks. We're assuming we live in a risk-free world. Mm-hmm. When banks meet and beat their numbers by draining, depleting loan loss reserves. And this is exactly what's happened because lending is still flat. Equity and fixed income trading, prop trading at these banks is flat or disappearing because of the regulators. And so where were the big winners that added to the P&L? You know what? Depletion of loan loss reserves. Money set aside for non-performing loans is being recategorized as current quarter earnings. This is so amazingly absurd. It's like saying that your personal rainy day fund, you go in and you break your piggy bank, and you go and use that for your day-to-day needs. It's like assuming that spending out of that emergency fund represents an increase in your personal income for a year and an improvement in your financial picture. Really?
Yeah.
And that's what they get away with reporting each quarter. We meet and beat our earnings report. Our profitability is better than ever. What were the shifts in terms of loan loss reserves to earnings? It is astounding. It is absolutely astounding. So we do come full circle. We have mountains of debt. We have very thin capital structures in the banking sector here and abroad. The prudential behavior is apparently to drain your rainy day fund because all the rainy days are behind us.
Mm-hmm.
And it sure looks to me like the same folks on the mountain, without the right equipment, without the right provisions, operating either with a sense of invincibility or ignorance.
Right.
Is that what Dodd-Frank was meant to create? Because that's what we have.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.